Hi, I'm Chloe McCulloch, Editorial Director of Building Magazine. This year is the 180th anniversary of our publication, and to mark this, we've launched the Building the Future Commission, one aspect of which looks at how we can build sustainable and desirable communities that people actually want to live in. The Commission is looking for best practice in urban design, and this is the accompanying podcast. Welcome to Building Talks, Creating Communities. New developments can face massive opposition, attacked for poor design, a lack of public services, and low quality civic space. These are the challenges we'll be tackling in this podcast by talking to built environment professionals. We'll explore their personal stories, influences, and motivations. And we'll ask, why is there so much interest in the placemaking agenda? And how can we make the places we work and live in better? Hello and welcome to the Building Talks Creating Communities podcast with me, Chloe McCulloch. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleague, Ben Flatman, who has spent the last few weeks interviewing key players in this field. Hi, Ben. Tell us about this week's guest.
Hi, Chloe. This week's guest is Anna Mansfield. She's a director at Publica, who are a well-respected urban design and urban strategy practice. I first met Anna while reporting on a new project in central London called Hanover. This is the overstation development above the Bond Street Elizabeth Line station. And initially, I was actually really focusing on the architecture. And what I noticed about the project was that the urban realm was really good. And I reached out to the practice who were responsible, Publica, and got chatting with Anna about her approach to these really important issues. I think what's really interesting about Anna's work and what Publica does is that they try and really bring out the essence of a place. They have a very simple approach to urban design. Anna even talks about avoiding the sort of wow factor approach, which is sort of overdone, I think, perhaps in a lot of developments. So it's a very sort of simple, stripped back approach to urban design that's about letting the place speak for itself.
Okay, well, that sounds fascinating. Let's have a listen to Ben talking to Anna Mansfield at Publica.
Hi, Anna. Thanks so much for having us in your office today. Your workplace is on the Victoria Embankment. There's a lot of noise outside that the listeners may hear during the interview. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about what that is and what it's like dealing with it in the workplace?
Hi, Ben. Welcome. Yes, it's the Thames Tideway Tunnel that's being constructed. It's the work site at Blackfriars. So when you go outside, you see it's a huge work site, one of the most important in the central section. So from a kind of geeky infrastructure point, I quite love it because I can see the entire site and it's really coming together and it's moving on. And it's such an important project to London, but it's probably a bit inconvenient for podcasts. So hopefully not too loud as we get forward.
Okay, well, let's see how we get on, shall we?
Great, yeah.
So Anna, I'd like to start the interview by asking you a little bit about your personal journey and how you've got to where you are today. So I was wondering whether you could just share with us a little bit of background about yourself and your influences. What got you interested in architecture and urban design originally? Was that fascination with the built environment there from a young age, or was it something you came to later in life?
No, at first I didn't want to do anything with the built environment. My dad's a structural engineer, and so I didn't run away from it, but it was my dad's work as a thing. So I started out going to art school. I started out going to Central St. Martin's, and I had an idea I was going to be a fashion designer, and that was my big dream. And then I got there and realized I didn't want to do that at all. That looked like a nightmare. It wasn't for me at that point. And then I fell in love again with, at that time it was product design and the design of buildings, but actually went on first to study interiors and design at that scale, and then came to architecture. So it was a bit of a long journey, really, from quite small scale design, getting bigger and bigger, followed on with an architecture degree, and then got a scholarship to go to the Architectural Association for my diploma. And at that point, got really into urban design. So I've taken this journey from quite small scale design all the way up to design of cities. But there's similarities in the process in all of those.
Brilliant. Thanks so much. I just wanted to ask you why it is you think that placemaking is so important and what you see as the key challenges for people seeking to create or reinvigorate a sense of place.
It's changed a lot. So I've been at Publica since the beginning. So that's about nearly 13 years now. And the conversations that we have are totally different to where we were 13 years ago, which I think is quite interesting. And in fact, people's interest in it and understanding has just transformed. It's completely different. So 13 years ago, there was huge boom in development and lots of spaces left over after planning, essentially. Lots of public spaces that weren't doing very much, were in overshadowed or windy bits of site, didn't really have any amenity value and weren't much loved by anyone.
Are we talking about London here or?
Yeah, everywhere. But London's, right. Well, I mean, if you think about that time, we were still building out, this was pre, well, the Athletes Village was being built for the Olympic Park. But so lots of things that are now finished were just underway then. There was an idea that if you build public space, it's such an inherent good that it would be great. But that's not the case. It needs some really good thought and thinking and design. And I think it'd been a bit overlooked. It was sort of the sense that, well, anyone can do that. It's just the stuff between buildings. I trained as an architect. I've worked as an architect. I've designed buildings. I love architecture. But I wanted to apply that sense to the stuff in between, essentially. So the conversation's moved on hugely, and there are brilliant practitioners in London, across the UK, making loads and loads of fantastic spaces. But you're right, I think we've still got a lot to learn, and there's still a long way to go.
So the focus has shifted perhaps from quantum to quality, perhaps.
Yeah. And that was already happening a lot. And then the pandemic came, and again, we saw actually what happens when these are the only places we have. But at the same time, we're in a place where the thing that worries me the most is that we're suffering a loss of the shared spaces that we have as society. So if you think about it, pubs, clubs, live music, all those other spaces where we meet people who are not the same as us, where we do things, they're all diminishing rapidly and they're disappearing, leaving public space as the last place where you meet other people.
Before we get onto your own work at Publica, I was wondering whether you can share a best practice example of where you think it's been done well by others. Like, can you think of any successful new communities or places and what makes them work?
Yes, it's hard to jump onto one. I think it's hard to pinpoint one, but I think there's lots of great stuff that's happened in London over the last decade. Loads of, so either from really amazing, huge projects like, say, Strand Aldwych, or thinking very differently now about the role of cars in cities and those kinds of things. That's really interesting. And then at smaller scale, lots of community gardens, lots of really amazing public spaces. So it's hard to jump on just one. I know in the industry, I would say one of the most influential things that's happened in this time has been the development of King's Cross, which has made people think very differently about mixed use and about public space, and the big move of having the art school and the kids and the fountains, everything in one place. It changed everything. Suddenly everybody wanted to do that. You see these big shifts. Likewise, Highline moved everything for a while. That's a very manicured type of public space. So you see these big industry shifts. But it's a city where we've got so many brilliant practitioners working at all different scales in central London, outer boroughs. The other thing that I would like to say is also that the mayor's office have got a huge role to play in that. Everything that they're doing with good growth by design really influences how that works across the city.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about Publica. It's a very sort of unique consultancy in its philosophy and its approach and your role here.
We actually started with a project in Hanover Square. There was a new public space going to be part of an overstation development coming with Crossrail. So a lot of London has changed because of Crossrail, especially central sections, which I'm sure we'll come back to later. But it was looking at what is the public benefit, because there was what's called planning harm, the removal of a listed part of the building, and was there true public benefit in the space that was proposed? So we did a big study really looking at who's there and when and what's missing, how you might weave things in, what's working really well nearby and when, and all throughout day and night, and trying to really get underneath it and really understand it, and work really closely with the architects, Lifshitz, Davis and Sanderlands. And it was a great project, actually. It was really well received, the design team and the planners, and it's open and it's great. And then we went on to design Hanover Square just outside it, which is just finally finished this week, which is really exciting. So it started from there and then has grown really organically into lots of different things. So our work is on a big sliding scale from pure research work for organisations like the GLA through to designing the stone and laying out the public spaces of, say Hanover and Bond Street, and in between a huge amount of strategic work. So we started working at the strategic scale and have ended up doing all these different things, and it's been through who's joined us and what we wanted to do on that way. I think the other thing that's quite interesting about Publica is we have a really mixed client base. So yes, lots of developers, as I've described, also many, many great estates. So currently working for Portman and Howard de Walden, but also Crown Estate and Grosvenor. They're really, really interesting clients. Also lots of amenity societies, say Soho and Queen's Park, but also Selfridges, King's College, GLA, TfL, borough, outer boroughs or inner boroughs like Newham, Society of London Theatres. What I think is interesting about that is that how all of those different organisations, very diverse, all have an idea about the city and what they want to do in the city and how they can influence it. And that's where we come in. So that's the most exciting thing for me about working at Publica. But also, I think probably one of the most exciting thing about cities is just how many people want to influence and shape them.
I know the work that you do is incredibly diverse, but I've just, one of the things I sort of noticed about the urban design work that you've done is that it feels like there's a really refreshing simplicity to the approach, and that there's a sort of desire not to overcomplicate things and to almost sort of let the city speak for itself and breathe. Does that accurately reflect the approach?
It really does, actually. It's such a nice way of saying it, because it's something we're reflecting on just this week at Hanover Square, actually, the opening. So when you're designing streets and spaces, it's not meant to be about that design. It's meant to be about the city and everything around it. And so in a way, the best thing, when Hanover Square opened, it just opened again after so long because of Crossrail construction. They opened the gates and people just went and sat back on the benches like it. And it was so nice. It wasn't, you know, obviously it had the ribbon cutting, but there is a point that it's not about just the design. So sometimes it works, you know, we have meetings, people say, well, it doesn't really have a wow factor, does it? And we have to say, well, it's not really meant to. It's a beautifully made street. It's part of the setting and the history and the context of London. And so it's one of those things where you work really hard to make something that looks very simple.
So I've actually been walking down Marylebone Lane quite a lot recently. I live nearby. I sort of subconsciously aware that it was different and working really well. Now, I think it's probably a really beautiful street to start with already, but I was just wondering whether you could just talk a little bit about what Publica has done there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting project, actually. So Marylebone Lane, that was really the start of when we started designing streets. So Howard de Walden had wanted to do something with Marylebone Lane to stop everyone walking down the high street and bypassing it. So they had a scheme, but it was quite transport. It was quite a transport scheme. So it worked about, you know, when you would let vehicles in, not, but it probably didn't have much joy, I think it would be fair to say. So we did a piece of strategic work for them, looking at who's coming day and night. And there's some really beautiful drawings about how the students from the cooking school use one part of the space, where the sun falls, all the conditions of the street, what it feels like to be there, really in depth. And they were a fantastic client. They really went with us on this. And it carried on. And our client, Andrew, at that time at Howard Alden, said, well, you should just design it. Are you sure? Yeah, let's do it. So we did it with WSP, our partners, and we worked with them a lot, which is great. And then it was a point of choosing really carefully the stone to reflect this lost river, but also there's lots of careful but small moves. Like you say, you know it's slightly different, but you're not sure why. And then very simple benches. And I really enjoy the one next to the high street where I always photograph it when I go down the street, because there's always someone there. It's really nice and very calm kind of a space. And the other thing that's really important about that street is the role of Howard de Walden, because they knew that you have to preserve certain shops on there, that the Button Queen has to stay, certain things have to stay. So it was a really, really good project from that point of view. So the design of it, but also how it works, it's a good lesson, I think.
So we've spoken there about existing places that you've helped restore or reinvigorate. I was wondering if there was a project where you sort of created or contributed to the creation of a new place, and how you approach that very sort of different challenge.
Yes, lots, actually. I'm trying to think of the most recent one, but we work a lot on master planning teams and always have, and work in collaboration with lots of other people. And it's one of those things where you're working out what kind of new spaces to put in really quite large places. So there's a big leap there, but also, how do you know what to put inside if you don't know what's outside? So we do these much wider area studies and see what's working and see what's missing. Because when you then go to meet people living and working nearby, it's quite disrespectful to not know what's working at the moment and what's there, and to ask really sensible questions about what's missing. You don't want to go making assumptions. So it's really good to see what's there. So we work a lot at what should come, but also real sense check about who's going to use this and when, and will it be exciting? What will activate it? So it's a really good design process, I think.
I know you've done quite a lot of research into inclusive environments for women, girls, children as well. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that work.
One of the things we've always done is really put research at the foundation of everything we do. We often describe ourselves as research-led designers. And so in our work, everything stems from the research, but also informs it. So it's a big circle, essentially. We design something, we learn more, we research to inform the design. And we worked with the GLA on a piece of guidance for them on making London child-friendly, which was really, really formative. It was just before pandemic. And it was such an important piece of work, because if you think, one of the things that we found out is between 1971 and 2010, the number of children in the UK who are allowed to walk to school by themselves had dropped from 86% to 25%. And that's only going in one direction. And we have lots of problems in London with childhood obesity and really poor mental health outcomes. And it was a big question about what kind of city are we building for children, or for any of us. And what I found, so I led that project, was that some things that we just take for granted, you look at through the lens of an urban childhood and they're just awful. Like, why do we live like that? Why do we accept certain things around air quality, around relegating pedestrian movement, the movement of cars? When you look at it, what it's like to be a child, you suddenly, it makes everything very vivid.
So what is it that we can do to make London more child-friendly?
There's lots of things. I mean, I think the first was, is really good of the GLA and with Mayor's design advocate, Dina Bornat, to really foreground this, and also Tim Gill, it's a fantastic campaign around this, to really foreground it so that people started to think about it. And in every master plan and every design that we started to think about it. So that piece of work says that, well, there are four main things you need to do is change policy, think about participation from the beginning of a project, how you manage spaces. So a few years ago, you've seen things in the press around children not being allowed into some of the public spaces in housing development, because this was the market housing and this was the affordable housing. That should never be happening. That was happening in the same time as we were doing this piece of work, and then was written into the London plan that can never happen again. So it's starting to really open eyes to this issue. And then, of course, and really importantly, is design. Designing spaces, thinking about where we put things for children, and not always putting play in children's provision as the last thing. Put it at the beginning of a project. What would that be like? Because children often know so much, always know so much about where they live, but are the last to be asked. And so you can turn outcomes for projects on their head if we start to think about those things differently.
We featured a comment piece in BD recently from Matt and Fiona, who are doing sort of really brilliant work in engagement with young people. I was just wondering if you had anything to say about giving young people more agency in the built environment, in its creation and design.
That is critical, basically. And so I think there's so many ways that it can be done from the beginning of projects, and there's really, really fantastic examples. So one of the examples that we featured in the work with the GLA was King's Crescent, which is MUF Art and Architecture. And they had been, from the outset of that project, doing some really interesting work with children and young people as the meanwhile uses around that project developed, and then creating really great play space and a great street right through the centre of it. But also we're finding more young people represented in local authorities, which is really good, because in much more of a decision, they're in the decision-making bodies. And a few years ago, we were doing some work on Oxford Street, and we were looking back at, there'd been so much consultation with everyone, but we realised no young people. And you think how important Oxford Street is to young people, and always has been. And so when we asked, no one's ever asked us this before, and such great things came out about which spaces they would never even think about going to and which were really important, and how they move around and that move around the spaces. So I think we should be at a turning point where bringing the voices of children and young people into projects is much more common.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the work on women and girls specifically, some of which I think is focused on women's safety
Yep.
in the public realm.
This is the work that's being led by Ellie Cosgrave. It's a really interesting and exciting program that she's looking at. So we've been supported by lots of great organizations in built environment, because obviously after everything that's happened, the realization of what it's like to be a woman in this city, and in fact lots of cities, has come to the foreground. And you get, with anything, a very small window to make change. We need to make sure that we capitalize on that and make change in the city. So the work that we're doing is bringing together lots of ideas and thought and best practice in the sector, but also bringing together lots of voices to try and create change. And some of it is around really practical things, you know, kind of street audits and walking around with women and girls, and others, bigger ideas about imagining future and change and making a much more inclusive, participative city.
So a lot of Publica's work has been focused on central London. Is that by design?
Not really, because everything grew organically. And so we started out with this very formative project in Hanover Square, which then led to other projects in the West End and led to lots of really good long-term relationships with the Great Estates, really good relationships with Westminster and Camden and other boroughs. Yeah, it wasn't really by design. We just started to build up a really big knowledge about all of these things, and then also a huge database of, say, photographing these streets and spaces, millions of photographs and maps about how they're used, such great maps of the West End. So we started, if you go onto our website, you can see where we started piecing together the land use of all the areas we'd studied, and it became a bit of a joke that we were covering them all in. But it was, we're just really curious about lots of places, so it's really exciting to go to new areas. It was a time, I think, where so much capital was flowing into London, that so much development was happening around Crossrail, that there was always some next thing to do, so it's a very busy time. And there was a while where it was more likely that we would get a call to do a project in Manhattan or Toronto than outside London, because they were more similar in some ways about the way that projects are being carried out. That's changed. And recently we're doing a lot more work in Manchester, which we have no desire to only be in London. It's just how it's been. But it's been a really, really interesting time to learn things here and to work amongst amazing built environment practitioners in London.
You mentioned Oxford Street earlier. Lots been written recently about how Oxford Street is struggling and the retailers are struggling. What do you think the future is for Oxford Street?
It's an interesting one. I love Oxford Street. I have always loved it since I was a teenager coming into London from Essex. So it's like, it was an exciting place. I was trying to explain to some young people the other day about Topshop and what it was and what it meant when you were 14 and you would come in from the suburbs to be in London. And I think it's an extraordinary place. And so many things have impacted it. You know, if you look at when Philip Green's empire went, it took about a quarter of the shops, or took a huge amount of the shops out in one go. It's really hard to withstand that. It's so different. If you think about Regent Street, Regent Street's in single ownership. You can curate it. You can do certain things with it. Much easier. Not much easier. That's not giving credit to how hard Crown Estate have worked. So I think we're not working on Oxford Street at the moment, but have extensively in the past. I'm really hoping that it comes back. But I think it's a pace of reinvention. The thing about Oxford Street is it was about innovation and it was about invention. And it's always been quite a mad, crazy place. If you read Virginia Woolf about Oxford Street, it was the same, but with horses. It was about crowds and busyness and democratic space, and so it needs to find that way to recapture all those things. I think it will come through innovation. I think whatever comes next, it's going to have slightly different land uses, because that age of retail is over. Department stores have changed, which is very sad, but I think it will have to come through reinvention. If we can find new life for those building types, that's going to be, they're tricky building types, a very deep plan, they're very of their kind. That has national consequences, because all the department stores have gone and they're really important places. If you think about where they were always in the most prominent position in a high street because they were the anchor. They had a civic purpose as well, and also a social purpose. So my grandmother passed away a couple of years ago, but before that point, she was an absolute store visitor of the department store in Ilford, where she was from, because it was warm, all her friends were there, she knew people, there was the cafe. So it had this very lively social scene of lots of people going there, and it's gone. It comes under the categories of things, like I said, of spaces that we're in together that did other things. The department store had warmth and toilets and loads of other stuff that's just not provided in the wider public space. So the civic role of those buildings, I'm really interested in what replaces them.
Historically, Selfridges was, you know, really important in terms of providing a space for women to get out of the home and socialize.
Exactly. And Selfridge said, I'm not interested in designing a shop. I want to design basically a series of public spaces or public space where people can be. And then that's so exciting. And yes, again, on Ox Street, so many of the department stores had these really interesting spaces for women because there were spaces they could be together. Really, really interestingly designed as well, which is, I think, lost and not understood. So that's where I think the future lies, in understanding what we've lost and that it needs to be recreated. The civic aspects need to be recreated.
So do you see the future of town centres and city centres moving away from over-concentration on retail that there's been in the last few decades to a more balanced mix?
Yeah, I think it will change, though I think things move so much. So at the moment, it's really, really hard for traditional retail to deal with fast fashion and huge. But there's a move away, a backlash again about the amount of deliveries and all of these things. So it may swing back another way. And if you think about other disruptive businesses in London, so we work really, really hard to think about cars and reducing car use in London. But then Uber and Deliveroo, you can have a personalized economy where you can have your breakfast delivered to your desk, which completely undoes all of that. So I think we need to get to an equilibrium where we start to appreciate again the purposes that could and should be in a town centre. And retail is a really important part of that. So is nightlife, the nighttime economy. We've done lots of work with a specialist director here, Satu Stretfield, on thinking about what a nighttime economy does. And that doesn't just mean bars and clubs, but thinking more expansively about the nighttime, what that can bring into places. And so they don't all just stop and become slightly desolate in the evenings. That could be really exciting for London, because that's less common than you think in London.
Thanks so much, Anna. It's been wonderful getting more of an insight into your work. Before we say goodbye, I just wanted to ask you three questions that I'll be asking all of the guests on this podcast series. And the first of those was, can you give me an idea of your favourite place? I think we all have an idea of what makes a good place, and I think often that derives from experiences of places that we've lived in or visited. I was wondering whether you could talk about where that place is for you.
So my favourite place in London is actually Soho. It feels like London to me. We've done lots of studies of Soho, and what's really interesting when we mapped it is you can see that it's so fine grain and the maps are so beautiful, and you can feel that when you're there. It's got everything, so you can really understand the history of the place there because its form is as it was laid out as fields. That's how white is harder to move in one direction through Soho than another, but it's the most exciting place to be in London because you can get lost and just be anywhere. And it's also fun and also very beautiful, so that's my favourite place. And it's a collection of public spaces.
I was wondering if you could just highlight an individual working in the built environment. Doesn't have to be an architect or urban designer, could be a client, somebody who you think's making a really important difference at the moment.
I think Roger Madeline has made a big difference to how we think about things. So that's developer side thinking, and if you hear him speak or walk around, say, Canada Water, it is very charismatic, but also when you see someone with quite a singular vision, you can really make change, and you can have the most brilliant design ever. You can have listened to everyone. You can do everything. You can try and bridge all of the conflicts that inevitably rise doing anything in any city or any space. But without a client with a vision and drive and purpose, it's really hard. It's really hard. I'm afraid that they've passed away, but Richard Rogers was always in my career, I looked at what he had done and what he had said and what he'd said about cities and the buildings he designed, and thought, that's what good looks like. There's joy as well as joy, and there's a sense that this is meant to be about people together having fun and being, you know, living life. And then, sorry, Yangel. It would be, everyone talks about Yangel, but we wouldn't be having many of the conversations we have in London if they weren't doing that great work.
I think one of your answers may already have given me an indication how you will respond to this final question, but it's an incredibly divisive scheme. But I always think it's interesting how many architects and urban designers actually express some sympathy for Poundbury as a model. I just wanted to ask you where you stand on the Poundbury question.
I have sympathy for the, I have sympathy for a kind of singular vision and to try and make something, do something, follow your values. I think that's great. I think it's a bit too restrictive. So it feels, I think for me, it probably inevitably ends up feeling a bit unreal. It doesn't have all the reality of the city. So if you think about me giving my example as Soho as my ideal space, it's probably the other end of spectrum because I think it's too controlled. So it's a strange thing about being a designer and being an architect, which is in some ways about control. Working in public realm is about letting go of control, about putting in some really good moves and then seeing what happens. And I think that's difficult to see how that can happen if it's too tightly designed at Poundbury.
I'd just like to ask you, Anna, if you could change three things or make three suggestions to improve the quality of placemaking in the UK, what would they be?
So I think I probably touched, none of these would be that surprising. I think I've touched on them in different ways in the course of our discussion. But I think the first and probably most important is making cities and the whole process much more inclusive. We just need to think much more expansively about how we design and who we're designing for. And I think the pandemic really, really highlighted that for everyone. The second, and in more of a sort of technical aspect about how we do our work, is I don't think as an industry we use data anywhere near enough. There's so much. Everyone is harvesting huge amounts of data and we're not using it in a smart enough or intelligent enough way to design with. And so I'm really excited about what we can do that makes cities just much smarter and much better and much more flexible. They don't all have to be working it the same way all the time, and we can learn from other cities in that. And the last, which is, I think some of my colleagues will laugh at, is I'm going to say public toilets, and they will laugh because I always bring them up, and not just toilets, civic and public amenity. And you read so many things, the impact across, and it's not just because we do lots of work in the West End, but we've lost lots of amenity, not just civic and shared spaces, lots of amenities that were put in for us all. And when these things go, they seem really small arenas, but they have a huge impact. And you can't design great spaces if the basics aren't there and those things have outsized impacts on everyone's life. So my view is that from the very big kind of high sense of what we do in the future of data, it's not to leave behind that some of our predecessors had really good expansive ideas about what was needed to all live together at density, and I think some of them have been lost.
Anna, thanks so much for your time and for having us, and good luck for the future.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks.
Okay, Ben, another fascinating interview. We've come to the end of our series now, but before we go, I thought it would be nice if we could sit back and reflect on what we've heard over the past few weeks from our guests.
Well, I think there are a number of themes that have really come to the fore through these conversations. And one of those is around actually the consensus that exists around what makes good urban design. I'm sort of erring away from calling it placemaking because so many of our guests have really queried and interrogated that term. One of the questions that I asked all of our guests was around their attitude towards Poundbury, and it did elicit some differing responses. But I think what was interesting was that everybody welcomed the attempt that's been made in Poundbury to create a mixed-use community, prioritizes walking and the inclusion of workplaces close to where people live. I think there can be a real tendency now, not just in discussions around the built environment, but you know, across a whole range of issues, to really couch things in terms of a culture war and make out that there are sort of fundamental differences about the solutions that we need to adopt to address these really important issues. I think it's really heartening to hear, therefore, people steering clear of very simplistic responses to a scheme like Poundbury, which, perhaps for all its faults, has sincerely tried to address what are now recognised as some of the most pressing issues facing the UK and the world around sustainability, around quality of environment. One of the other things that's really interesting, and it relates to this querying of the whole term placemaking, is that everybody is placing emphasis on the importance of place and really recognizing that everywhere has value and that we need to work harder to recognize that and bring out the inherent qualities of, you know, even the most regular high street, regular community around the country.
So Ben, if you're thinking about what you take away from all of these conversations and looking to the future, how hopeful do you feel now about the UK's ability to create successful communities?
I think one of the things that comes out very clearly is there's a huge amount of talent and a huge amount of energy and enthusiasm in the UK for creating good places. I think what we lack perhaps is the coherent government response and framework within which that can take place. And we really need to see an improvement in the resourcing of planning departments and local authorities to enable them to put in place the framework that will allow the architects, urban designers and developers to really deliver quality new places and communities that we all want to see over the coming decades.
You've been listening to the Building Talks Creating Communities podcast. We hope you've enjoyed the series with me, Chloe McCulloch, and Ben Flatman. Series producer was Tariq Aziz. We're taking a short break for now, but hope to be back in the near future. In the meantime, you can find out more about the Building the Future Commission at building.co.uk and more about urban design issues at our sister title, bdonline.co.uk. Goodbye.